is that Unger's motion to dismiss on due process grounds should have been granted where the general district court improperly punished her summarily when she was entitled to a notice and hearing for alleged indirect contempt. Direct contempt is conduct committed in the presence of the court and may be punished summarily because the court can proceed on its own knowledge of the facts and has perfect knowledge. Indirect contempt, on the other hand, is conduct committed not in the court's presence, but that it arises at a distance and of which the court cannot have perfect knowledge.
Ms. Dalton, may I ask you at this point, isn't also direct contempt, didn't you exclude the second part of subsection 1?
No.
It's or so near thereto as to obstruct the or interrupt the administration of court. Isn't that also a part of summary contempt?
Yes, that is a part of summary contempt. I would suggest that there is no conflict between the current law on direct and indirect contempt and the second part of subsection 1 of the statute. My understanding of subsection 1 of the statute would be, of the second part of subsection 1 of the statute, would be behavior that may not be directly in front of the court, but that the court still could perceive. For example, if there are an inmate in the holding cell who was banging on the wall, and so it wasn't in the presence of the court, but the court could still perceive it completely. It would not need witnesses to testify, or if there was...
Well, in that scenario, how could the court perceive it completely if there's only one person in the holding cell? Is that your hypothetical?
Sure. If there's one person in the holding cell, or perhaps the court could observe through the courthouse doors, if they were transparent, that there's someone in the hallway cursing, and that disrupts court. They could have that person brought into court, and then that would be behavior that was not directly in the presence of the court, but would still disrupt the court proceedings or the administration of justice as the statute provides. As both this court and the Supreme Court of Virginia have held, if some essential elements of the offense are not personally observed by the judge, such that he must depend upon the statements of others for his knowledge of these elements, then due process requires that the accused be afforded notice and hearing. In Scaldone v. Commonwealth 279, Virginia 422 in 2010, the Supreme Court of Virginia, in determining whether contempt was direct or indirect, addressed two questions. First, did the contemptible conduct in the case occur in the presence of the judge where all of the essential elements of the misconduct were actually observed by the court? And
counsel, assuming we agree with you that this is a form of indirect contempt, how do you get around the law relating to the line of cases, the Gilman and those line of cases, in terms of getting us past a procedural bar, as the Commonwealth points out?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that I understand your question, but I don't read there to be any procedural bar because we're not alleging that the statute is constitutional. My reading of subsection 2, the first part of the summary contempt statute, would be consistent with Gilman, Parham, Scaldone, all the history of cases distinguishing direct and indirect contempt. That the distinguishing factor would not be proximity to the judge, but the distinguishing factor would be did there need to be other witnesses? Did there need to be additional evidence? In the Scaldone case, the trial court held two attorneys and the attorney's law clerk in contempt for fraudulent documents to the court that also include personal insults about the judge. And in Scaldone, there's sort of a mixed situation where the offering of the document was in the trial court's presence, and the court immediately suspected the document was altered. However, the court's investigation of the possible contempt required the court to call witnesses and examine additional documents. Thus, the trial court did not have complete personal knowledge of the misconduct, and the Supreme Court held that a summary contempt proceeding was improper. As this court held in Heffernan in 2014, an unpublished case, the appellant was held in summary contempt for making profane and threatening statements to an attorney in the hallway during a recess and outside of the judge's presence. And this court held that the trial court's knowledge that served, the knowledge of the conduct that served as the basis of the summary contempt necessarily depended on statements made by others. And thus, this court held it was an error to hold Heffernan in summary contempt and reverse her summary contempt conviction. In this case, the general district court judge's finding necessarily dependent on the deputy's statement as to what happened at the lockup facility. Because without the deputy's statement to the court could not have found Unger in contempt. It could not have been summary contempt, and that's our argument as to why she's improperly held in summary contempt. With respect to my second argument, that on appeal, Unger had no opportunity to present evidence or explanation to the court.
Well, let me ask you something before you move on.
Certainly.
So your first issue relating to what the district court judge did wrong in your assessment, doesn't that go away when the circuit court has its own appeal, whatever? Because you proceeded under the particular appeal statute.
Right.
And so basically what the district court did becomes irrelevant when the circuit court hears the case, correct?
I think the circuit court, because it's reviewing the certificate, is also reviewing what the general district court did, and in particular because Unger argued a motion to dismiss in circuit court alleging that the general district court had violated her due process rights, the circuit court was able to review in the certificate that the general district court judge had had to rely on the statements of the deputy in order to make her finding of contempt. And thus the circuit court was in a position to fully address the motion to dismiss on due process grounds, even though the due process violation had occurred in general district court.
Okay, but you proceeded under 459. The appeal proceeded under 459.
The appeal was of a summary contempt finding under 456, and then...
But...
Yes, and
it
then...
It proceeded under 459, so those are the... For purposes of this case, that's the procedure that was applied.
Yes, and I don't think that this court has ever ruled as to whether that would be an appropriate disposition for indirect contempt, but because Unger was actually appealing a finding of summary contempt, although for in the motion to dismiss in circuit court, we alleged that was incorrect. When the circuit court judge denied that motion, they then had to proceed
under.
As if it was summary contempt.
Okay.
So as to the second argument, if this court finds that it was summary contempt in general district court, Unger still maintains that her due process rights were then violated on appeal in circuit court because she was not permitted to present evidence on her own behalf to refute the information contained in the certificate.
I want to focus not on the constitutional aspect of that argument, but the statutory one.
Okay.
What is Ms. Unger's definition of legal testimony?
I'm not sure that she knows, and certainly the phrase legal testimony, based on my research, appears nowhere else in the code but for the 18.2 459.
It's in at least two other code sections.
Oh, is it? I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I didn't find it when I searched
okay.
for it. I don't know what definition. There weren't any.
No, there were no definitions in any of it.
And I couldn't find any case law that defined what legal testimony is meant under the statute. However, there are two cases, one from this court sitting in Bonk, Rosario v. Commonwealth in 2007, and again, Scaldone from 2010, the Supreme Court of Virginia, that suggests that even in cases of direct summary contempt and even on appeal, the appellant is entitled to introduce evidence to refute the allegations of contempt in the certificate to explain her conduct or to produce reasons why she should not be punished. In Rosario, for example,
if legal testimony were taken to mean just testimony that is otherwise admissible,
okay,
would we be able to resolve the appeal based purely on the statutory argument and not reach your constitutional question?
I'm not sure I understand the court's question.
We try to avoid constitutional questions.
Certainly.
And we can avoid them. If we find that the statute entitled her to introduce evidence,
then yes, the court could resolve it without addressing the constitutional. If the court could resolve, I guess, the meaning of the statute either way.
Did you preserve it as in an assignment of error that way?
No, I don't know that it was preserved that way. I think that it was, well...
I mean, your argument is due process.
Yes.
And to the extent that the definition of legal testimony would affect that.
Well, I think that if this court finds that legal testimony would include any admissible evidence, and I think the court would have to find that Unger's due process rights were violated in that she was not afforded the statutory
right, so the definition bootstraps back to your
I think they're related, yes.
Okay. Counsel, you're into your rebuttal.
I will save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Bourne.
Good morning. May it please the court. Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the Commonwealth of Virginia. You know, nobody has addressed the huge, I guess, for lack of better phrase, elephant in the room dealing with these contempt cases. And for a long time, and upon reading all of these cases, we sort of skirt around the issues with the statute. But we have a statute, 18.2456, that defines what summary contempt is. And what it defines summary contempt as is misbehavior in the presence of the court, or so near thereto, and so that must mean something else other than in the presence of the court.
Well, that's correct, and there are some cases, albeit unpublished, that talk about when you're right outside the courtroom or when you're within essentially arm's reach or ear reach of what's going on. That's not the scenario in this case.
But of course, Your Honor, the problem that I would argue with that is that the statutory language is the statutory language. And if it is overbroad and it includes things that perhaps are not right in the presence of the court, then the statute must be found to be unconstitutional. We can't say, well...
Does the statute have to be found to be unconstitutional? It can be unconstitutional as applied in a particular...
Well, none of that was actually raised as an assignment of error in this case. If that were the argument that were raised, I might be in a different position. But there was a specific disavowal that there was any problem with this statute below.
Well, now, in fairness, at the trial level in the circuit court, the attorney made it very clear that the challenge was to the due process as applied to the defendant. And so much so that the trial judge specifically said, well, this is, you know, there's no due process problem here.
But the issue, but the trial judge...
So how is it not preserved below?
Because the trial judge also said, and I think recognized the problem in this case, and said, are you saying that this statute is unconstitutional? And the answer was no,
yeah,
I'm not saying
that. There's two claims. One is you can challenge a statute as being unconstitutional at its face, or you can say as applied. And what they were saying is my client was entitled to due process here and didn't get it.
But they specifically said,
and the judge ruled on the due process issue.
But I would argue that by saying that the statute, she said, my behavior fell within the statute. She didn't challenge the sufficiency of the statute as applied to her, and she said the statute was not unconstitutional. And just to say, therefore, that there's a statute that is perhaps a problem, but then to say that it's not, the statute is not unconstitutional. If it is unconstitutional, it has to be unconstitutional because it's overbroad and you have to challenge the statute. That's my position.
You can challenge it as applied.
But that's not what this argument is. Well, she's not saying that there's any problem with the statute.
I'm on page 4 of your brief, quoting page 21 of the appendix. You're detailing this interaction between the trial judge and counsel. And counsel responds, I'm not suggesting that section 18.2456 was unconstitutional. I'm suggesting that the summary judgment that was imposed was not constitutional because of the nature of the offense. That sounds like an as-applied argument to me.
Well, I would respectfully disagree.
Why?
Because she's saying that my conduct falls within the statute. She does not ever say her conduct doesn't fall within the statute. And the judge specifically says, well, here's this part of the statute, and I find that your behavior falls within this part of the statute. And are you saying that the statute is therefore unconstitutional? And she says, no, I don't say that. And
then says something else. I'm suggesting that the summary judgment, the summary contempt that was imposed is not constitutional because of the nature of the offense, which sounds like if you find that that the summary contempt statute allows you to punish without witnesses, without notice, with two categories of things the judge observes and things that are close, she's saying mine arguably fits in the second category, but you still can't get there in this case as to me because of the nature of my offense.
Well, I would argue that, and I mean, we can obviously my answer is not going to satisfy you, Your Honor, but what I would say is that you still have to say that there is a problem with the statute, because what we're going to end up with in this case, and the reason we're asking for guidance from the court in this case, is because the statute is still going to say what the statute says. And judges are going to look at that statute and say, wow, this covers this very scenario. It must mean something other than in the presence of the court. And it actually covers all of these other things. And therefore, we're going to keep having these contempt cases coming up, and you're going to have to keep either reversing them, et cetera, because the statute, which has been in place since 1831, has consistently made this behavior a violation that's amenable to summary contempt. So that's where we are. And I would say that there's also this difficulty because we have a summary contempt below, and there's no evidence that she put on any evidence below in district court. And there's some question about when you come up on an appeal de novo. I would argue it's not a trial de novo. And so if the circuit court is actually functioning as a mini appellate court in that situation, why do you have any ability to put on any evidence?
Well, because the statute says so. It says legal testimony.
But nobody knows what that means.
Oh, we know what it means. I mean, the definition, again, this is a very convoluted, tricky scenario, which we all readily admit. But there is some authority as to what legal testimony would be.
Well, and I would just point out to the court that it presents a strange situation when you have a summary contempt proceeding below where you did not present any evidence allowing the judge to hear what your mitigating evidence is. And then you go up, and then in a new trial, which is not a trial de novo, then you can present evidence that you didn't present below.
We don't disagree. It's a difficult
Says legal testimony, and you know, I looked out of state, and there was very little help in defining what legal testimony was.
Well, I think we can all agree it's not legal argument, correct?
Well,
the judge said.
Well, what we do know is that he did give her an opportunity to present evidence in disposition, and that I would argue is at least satisfies the summary contempt.
You're guilty. You don't get to put on evidence that you're not guilty, but you get to talk now?
He said, do you have anything to say in regards to mitigation?
And I think she said Judge Atlee had a question for you.
Yes.
No, mine's Ms. Dalton.
Okay.
So, unless the court has further questions for me.
One question. If we find that legal testimony means she got to put on it, she was supposed to be put on evidence. Two parts. One, is that preserved? And two, assuming it is preserved, can the case be resolved on that ground without reaching the constitutional?
No, it was not preserved. And assuming that it is preserved, I suppose, I mean, if she had made that argument and you find that legal testimony
testimony allows her to put on evidence.
Okay. And that there was a violation of the statute, but there was no assignment of error alleging a violation of the statute. So the violation was that there was a due process violation. That's the allegation. So you would have to find that there's a due process violation in this case. I mean, there's no statutory argument before the court.
I'm asking you to assume the statutory argument is preserved.
If she had argued that it was a violation of that her statutory rights were violated and that she wasn't allowed to present legal testimony, maybe. But clearly that's not the argument that was made here. There was just only a due process violation presented.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Ms. Dalton, may I ask you at the outset?
Yes.
Would we be in agreement that the deputy that was handling the drug test on behalf of the judge in this case was an agent of the court?
Yes.
And an officer of the court?
Yes.
So what do we do with subsection 5 on the summary contempt statute that reads, disobedience or resistance of an officer of the court, juror, witness, or other person to any lawful process, judgment, decree, or order of the court?
I would submit to the court, to this court, first, that that is not how the court found that Unger was in summary contempt, and I don't think that that would resolve the issue of it still being indirect contempt, and that additional evidence that would the trial judge, the general district court judge, would have perfect knowledge of.
Right. So if you go back to your holding cell analogy,
mm-hmm.
and the judge is to bring this person back from the holding cell, and they are raising Cain with the deputy and resisting the deputy, that then takes it from the direct contempt that you were talking about with the judge just hearing what's going on versus then the resistance that's involved in that?
I think it depends on if the judge observes it themselves or needs the desk.
But under what you brought up about the holding cell, the judge can't observe it.
I think that the judge can observe it in the sense of perceiving it with their other senses. That if a judge, as Judge Russell pointed out, there's only one person in the holding cell, and you hear someone screaming obscenities, banging on the wall.
We add a second person to that story, and the judge can hear the screaming, can hear the banging on the wall, but doesn't see the resistance. The judge would not then be entitled to solicit any evidence from the deputy about the resistance that's involved as well to amplify this, or does that then take it into an indirect contempt?
I think the judge is always entitled to investigate and to ask witnesses, ask the deputies. I think that puts it into the indirect contempt.
Particularly in a matter that's actually still pending before the court, and the court is waiting for results of, and has direct control over, and has directed to occur.
I still think under the current law that it would, the court could investigate then, the court could continue to investigate that investigation then, but would still need to afford the defendant certain notice and due process, hearing, opportunity to present evidence, that sort of thing.
Yes, ma'am.
Just briefly to follow up on the first argument, I think that the Attorney General is simply imposing arguments on Unger that Unger is not making. With respect to the second argument, the confusion came in primarily because the circuit court, in reading 459, didn't understand what legal testimony meant, interpreted it to mean legal argument, and prohibited Unger from presenting evidence in any form. If the court has any other questions.
Counsel, how is the due process argument preserved under your second assignment of error?
The due process argument is preserved in the circuit court based on trial counsel's motion to set aside. With respect to on appeal, the argument would be that Unger has the right to present evidence or to, at a minimum, refute the contents of the certificate, even on appeal of a summary contempt finding. And thus, her due process rights were violated by the circuit court, which is our assignment of error. That the due process rights were violated, whether it's a statutory interpretation, if this court does find that for indirect, I know this court has already found for summary contempt, for direct summary contempt, that 459 applies. But additionally, our first argument and our second argument are connected in the sense that even for the second argument, we're assuming that this court may find that it was properly summary contempt, but we're still maintaining as part of our argument that it was indirect contempt in the lower court, and thus she would be entitled to the same notice and hearing on appeal. Thank you.
All right. Case is submitted. Come down and greet counsel.